It is Wednesday, and if it's Wednesday, it means Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us almost every Wednesday. In the third hour, your favorite doctor joins us to answer your questions and bust myths. He's a professor in pediatrics, professor of pediatrics, director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's the author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health. The sequel to that is called Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. But he and his co-author, Dr. Rachel Vreeman, have now come out with their third myth-busting book. This one is called Don't Put That In There, Sex Health and Myths Debunked. Although as close as we are, and as often as he's been on, I do not have a copy of this book. So I will do my best to interview him about this book that I have not received a copy of. Now, I get copies of books from guests I've never met in advance, but of course, I did not get one from my good friend Aaron Carroll. His last book, I got a box to give away to listeners. This one, not one copy. Not for me, not for Alfred, not for any listeners. Nothing. No copies that Don't Put That In There in 69. Other sex myths debunked. Why 69?
Because they thought that would sell.
It would sell if I got a copy of the book.
Oh, my God, you know that was not my choice or my fault.
How are you?
I'm very annoyed about that.
Let's quickly, before we get to the book, talk about this Hobby Lobby case, because you wrote a piece.
Sure.
It's also a contributor to the New York Times, by the way, I should mention, and the Incidental Economist, and Healthcare Triage. Can you get John Green on the show?
I doubt it, but I guess I could.
He would never do a show like mine.
It's not that he would never do a show like yours. I can just imagine that he's not going to do anything for a long time.
Really?
Yeah, I think he. I mean, I can't speak for him, but I would imagine that after the movie and everything else, he's burned out and wanting to just disconnect from it.
What's the book in the movie? What's it called?
The Fault in Our Stars.
The Fault in Our Stars. You read it, right, Melanie?
Yeah, I read it last summer.
And
it's a tearjerker, there, Pete. It's a tearjerker.
How did you meet John Green?
He did one of his, like, his Vlogbrothers videos on healthcare spending in the United States. It was, like, one of the long ones. And he took a lot of information with attribution from my blog, and then someone noted it on Twitter and said, hey, you know, the two of my favorite people or something like that. And I guess he looked at that point. He didn't realize I lived in Indianapolis, and he contacted me and said, I love your blog. Can we get together for coffee so I can thank you? And I said, sure. And when we did, he talked about that they wanted to do a show on health or health policy, and would I be interested? And of course I was, and that's Healthcare Triage.
And you guys have become friendly.
Yeah, I would say that, yes.
Yeah. Friendlier now than you and I.
No, that would never happen.
Last week in Aspen, I was hanging out with one of your best friends.
Yes, that's true, actually. Yeah, it's a small world, isn't it?
We're now closer than you and him are. Todd and I are really close.
I assume you're closer than you and I. I knew you'd replace me instantly.
How the Hobby Lobby ruling could limit access to birth control. That's the title of your piece at the New York Times. Why? Come on. Liberals are up in arms about this. It's just, first of all, birth control is affordable. You don't need health insurance to cover it. It's really cheap. And secondly, it's only a couple of forms of birth control that they're now limiting under this ruling. So what is all the complaints about, and what is your piece about?
Well, let's back up, because I'm not even sure. No one is sure yet, because the Supreme Court keeps sort of changing it about whether it's limiting all forms of birth control or just a few. But you're right that the case was brought about because of a few specific forms of birth control. It was the IUDs and emergency contraception. And the reason that Hobby Lobby stated that they wanted not to cover these is because they consider them abortifacients, that they are causing pregnancies to fail as opposed to sort of preventing fertilization. So, the first thing to note is that most doctors consider an implanted fertilized egg pregnancy, because even naturally in the body, lots of times eggs will get fertilized and then not attach, not implant. They will just sort of pass on out. And that's not considered a miscarriage for the most part. It has to implant and it has to start. Even saying that, though, much of what I was writing about was just about what we know about how these forms of contraception work. And emergency contraception There's a fairly large amount of evidence at this point that shows that it prevents ovulation, it prevents fertilization, not that it prevents implantation, so much so that, you know, it seems fairly conclusive that the original birth, you know, forms of emergency contraception were all about preventing ovulation. Some of the newer forms of emergency contraception, we just don't know yet, but it still leans towards the idea that it's preventing fertilization. And the same is true with IUDs. They've done studies where they will monitor women very closely to see whether the hormone surge occurs with fertilization. And they, what they did with one of the studies that I talked about, and this is also in the book, by the way, is that they followed groups of women. One group was had their tubes tied, so there's no way they could obviously get pregnant. One group had IUDs, and one group was trying to get pregnant. And they followed them very closely with monitoring their hormone levels over the course of like 18 months, and they found that the hormone surge showing that fertilization occurred only happened in the group trying to get pregnant. In other words, there was no even fertilization at all in the group that had the IUD, which would, again, add evidence to the fact that it's preventing fertilization. It's preventing the sperm from getting through. That's how IUDs work. And there have been even further studies where they found that that hormone surge is almost never occurs, and in the rare instances occur, that almost aligns exactly with the amount that IUDs fail, because, again, they fail. Sometimes women do get pregnant, meaning that the egg fertilizes, the egg attaches. And so, you know, there is no evidence, really, that shows that these things are preventing pregnancies from taking root, that they are abortifacients. But that is what people believe, and they took that case forward. And that was what half of my piece was about. The other half is about the fact that it's already incredibly hard for women to get this kind of contraception. We can, you know, people say birth control is cheap. That's because it's most likely men, and they're talking about condoms. IUDs can cost like $1,000 by the time all is said and done to have them, the doctor's visit, the procedure to put them in, everything else. $1,000 is a fairly large amount of money for people at the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum. And even if you're just talking about emergency contraception, that can be like $45-$50. And if you need, that's a lot in one shot for a lot of people. It's amazing to me how flippant people can be about other people's finances, remembering that, you know, if you make $15,000 a year and you're a single mom with a kid, you are too rich for Medicaid, or you used to be too rich for Medicaid in the United States in most places. And so, you know, even at 133% of the poverty line, you know, you make $20,000 a year, you're probably getting private insurance. And if you're getting private insurance or you're dependent upon someone to provide you that insurance, because Hobby Lobby workers are probably not high-wage earners, you don't have tons of disposable income if you're making that little money and you have, you know, a family or anything else. So it is just not easy. And when you even throw in fact further that it's already incredibly hard to get emergency contraception, there was a great study published in JAMA done by actually a health services researcher that I know, and she's awesome, and she lives in actually Los Angeles now. But she basically cold called or had her research assistants cold call pharmacies all over the place and ask them, do you carry emergency contraception? And sometimes she had people call as doctors, and sometimes she had people call as adolescents, and sometimes she had people call as adults. And what she found was that if they were 17 or 18 and they were young and they were legally able to get it, the pharmacies would, and I lack a better word for this, lie, and tell them that they didn't carry it or that they weren't allowed to have it. They would not say the same thing to doctors.
What, they would say their age on the phone?
In other words, they would say, like, I'm 17 and I know I'm supposed to be able to get it, but I just wanted to make sure. And they'd be like, no, you're not allowed to get it.
And then they'd call back the same one as a doctor?
The same ones at a different time as a doctor. The doctors were given misinformation like 3% of the time, and the adolescents were given misinformation like closer to 20% of the time. And not only that, but tons of them just either said they didn't have it, period, or they didn't have it, period. In other words, at a huge percentage, what they would tell them, it wasn't even available. So roadblocks exist. You know, studies have shown that if you tell pharmacies, hey, you're not allowed to dispense stuff based upon your moral beliefs, a percentage of them will say, well, then I won't give it out anymore. Roadblocks exist, and every single additional roadblock we put up to try to get to prevent women from having emergency contraception leads to more pregnancies and more unwanted pregnancies in the United States, and theoretically leads to, therefore, more abortions, because you imagine that, that those women will want to get, you know, some percentage of them will want to get an abortion. So, you know, these steps we take to prevent access to birth control, they have meaning, and people will sort of dismiss this as, oh, there's other ways to do it and everything else, but it's already hard enough, and it's documented by research that it is hard, and this is one step that makes it harder.
Well, people just need to be more responsible and not have sex and not have an unwanted pregnancy. Why is that so hard for you to understand?
This is what is meant by being responsible. Plus, you gotta. Here's the thing, though. You know, everybody imagines it's always like unwed mothers. Tons of women, married women, are on birth control, and married women are very likely to be on the types of birth control like the pill or IUD that we're talking about here.
These married women can also choose not to have sex if they don't want a child.
Well, I guess if that's the plank that everybody wants to go on in the next election, they should feel free.
I will prevent married women from desiring sex.
Married women. We're not talking about, you know, we talked about this before. IUDs are awesome. IUDs are amazingly powerful when they work. And, you know, once they're in, you don't have to think about it. It's worldwide. It's a very common form and very successful form of contraception used often by, you know, people who are being responsible and saying, I don't want to have a baby in the next few years. Not that they're even saying, like, you know, I'm not thinking and I'm getting. And that is what we mean usually by being responsible. So at that point, we're almost saying we just don't want you to have sex.
I had my vas deferens snapped in half, cut into a knot. I love that.
Is that covered by insurance?
Yes.
Well, then I guess we're good with the men.
I think it is. I think it was, yeah.
With covering men's, you know, contraception.
Yeah, yeah. Heather in New Jersey called earlier. I told her to call back because she had a Medicare question. I've got to get to the book.
Sure.
About sex. And we're going to talk about a lot of sex this hour and the myths debunking it. But go ahead, Heather. Thank you for calling back.
You know, I was almost crying on the phone, but then listening to you guys, it makes me laugh, so I feel better. I actually have birth control in my arm. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yes, sure. Norplant, or probably your depot.
That's it, yeah. And I have something.
What is it? Hold on. What is it?
I forget what it's called. I mean, he said Norplan, but there was something else, like Intra.
I mean, there's a few different forms, but basically it's a little, almost like, looks like a little capsule or rod, but it slowly releases the same kind of hormones you get in the pill. And again, well, some of them last a long time, some of them last a couple months. It's, you know, there's various forms of it, but they put it under your skin of your arm.
Well, you know what's funny? When I got it, I shouldn't say this nationwide, but... It left a bruise in the shape of a penis on my arm.
Nice.
Was that from that, or were you hit with a penis?
From shoving it out. No. It was
you
awful.
May have been hit by a penis accidentally.
That's how you
do it. I come in 2 weeks later, and the doctor had to check it, and they had to show every nurse in the office, and everybody was laughing, and it was really funny.
Okay. That's great. Yeah, I don't think that's a normal thing, but I mean...
No, don't be afraid to get it. It's great.
Yes.
But
that is another form, but that one definitely works by preventing ovulation. It works very much like the pill with the hormones, but it just, instead of having to remember to take it every day, they put it in, and you don't have to think about it.
Yeah,
and I just want to say I love Planned Parenthood. I never get to thank them enough, because when I got out of the Air Force, I don't know what I would have done without them. I didn't have insurance, so they are awesome. They just helped me so much.
Yeah,
so.
Planned Parenthood prevents more abortions than any other organization in the world.
So, but on to my question about, my situation is my brother-in-law is in a nursing home with Huntington's, and for the last 3 years I've handled his administrative affairs, and it's just been a nightmare with Social Security disability. And then also now Medicare is awesome because they just automatically put you on it after 2 years. But Medicaid, me and my husband are going to court tomorrow because they've denied it. And they have treated us just like crap, like just nothing. They don't answer phone calls. Just the fact that we have to get a lawyer.
What state do you live in?
New Jersey.
Okay.
And so he had assets. He was a programmer, lived in Texas, like made a six-figure income, and now everything's falling apart. And, you know, the five-year thing, I just wish they could take that away. I realize millionaires shouldn't – I understand why everything is – why it is, but can't they do something different? Like, is there any hope for any change to make this easier on families when they're filing? Because it's just...
Wish I had a yes for you. But, you know, Medicare's nursing home provisions are not great. They've never been great.
Yeah.
Our long-term care facilities have never been great. They, Medicaid has been, of course, much better in the long term, with the thought that, you know, well, we want to help those who are at the very low end of the socioeconomic spectrum. Of course, this ignores the fact that nursing homes are very expensive, and then we're now caught in the same bind that we were caught in with the an introduction of Medicare, is that people get old, and if they need long-term nursing care, the question is, do you deplete all your resources to get them to be destitute so they qualify for Medicaid and they go in, or, you know, do you try to, like, suck it up at home, or what do you do? There is no good answer.
Well, he can't be at home because he, like, needs 24-hour care.
Yeah,
well,
I
guess we could, but then I don't even know how to do that. But
It's also had a detrimental effect economically on your family. You know,
right.
If you have to take care of him and
but
you can't go to work.
Going to argue for a long time that
right.
you have that he has resources that you should be spending all of them first. And
yeah, 5 years. They go back 5 years, and now they're. I mean, like, we haven't paid the nursing home since last September, and we're getting pressured by the nursing home, and they have horrible tactics because they have their own lawyers. It's just,
yep.
it's a complete nightmare.
Wow.
Yes.
Man.
And this is why they try to fix things with. They tried as part of the ACA to have a long term care program, but that got stripped. And it's,
really.
Well, the class act and all of that. I mean, this is a lot of what you know, the class program and all that. So we don't want to do. This is one of those where we still put our head in the sand and we pretend like long-term care issues don't exist.
Right.
You know,
okay.
Most countries, be them private, be them socialized medicine, be them whatever single payer, that doesn't really matter. Many of them do some form of long-term care almost outside of the healthcare system because. At some point, everyone's going to need help. And so these, thinking about this in advance is part of it, but not here. No, but sort of we're all every man for yourself. And unfortunately, that means the people that need the most care, it almost always comes down to, like, spend all your own money first.
Right.
And when you get down to nothing, then we'll start talking about what we can do for you. But,
yes.
But that's tragic in the sense that, like, everybody who's so worried about the estate tax and passing on their wealth to the next generation, and I work so hard and I want to be able to help my kids or my grandkids and everything
else.
You
can't. No.
It makes it almost impossible.
I mean, you
Heather,
have kids, thank God. But yeah. Thank you for taking my call.
It's great to hear from you. I'm sorry about that situation, but always love that you're listening. And then I think it's Heather that tweets as well, Heather S. Okay, so let's talk. Let's talk sex. This
sure.
new book is out. It's available, and I want everybody to go buy it as a way to support Dr. Carroll, who joins us almost every week and loans his brain to us, answers all your questions. Go buy this book right now. Don't put that in there and 69 other sex myths debunked. Buy the other two as well. I mean, these are great books to have and to reference and to challenge your friends and family with because they're myth busters, and Dr. Carroll and his co-author, Dr. Rachel Vreeman, have a new book out, and we're very excited to ask you all about it. This is going to be fun. It's all sex coming up. Here we go. Are we ready?
Let's do it.
Well, first of all, what would you say is the most commonly held myth, sexual myth out there? Can you say?
Nah. I mean, that one I'm guessing. I don't know. The size of people's men's penises, that's got to be...
The size of, well, what about it, though, that it matches?
Think, what do you think the average man's penis is?
The average?
Yeah.
Six.
Oh, you're closer.
We're talking about an erect penis, right?
Yes, of course, seven. It's just one of those where it's like, it's sort of fascinating because, of course.
Seven?
That's what people say. Oh, God.
Okay. That's what people say. Well, what is it?
But that's part of the problem is, like, you know, this is one of those things you can't do a study by asking men to report the size of their penis because they say seven. And so when they do a lot of studies where they do the asking, the numbers actually come out higher. So based on, like, surveys, you get actually between 5.5 and 6.5. Still not seven, but you get much closer to seven. But there was a great study where urologists went right in there and measured it. They did it by doing stretched penile length, which is, like, you know, a procedure to actually, like, try to see what the maximum length of the penis might be. And they found that in a study of, like, more than 1,600 American men, the average length of the penis was actually closer to 4.7 to 5.1 inches, so closer to 5 inches, actually.
Erect?
Erect. That's what, like, stretched penile length, you know, is the sort of erect length. That's how big can it get. The actual probably likely average size of a man's penis in the United States is probably closer to 5.
You keep saying, first of all, that makes me feel good, because
helping everyone out today. Buy a book.
But you keep saying United States, so do we myth bust? You're a Jewish man.
Yes.
Asian men versus black guys. I mean,
you know,
what about...
There are no great studies where they, like, lined up men of different ethnicities. But, you know, there is sort of a running sort of, again, belief, and I don't say myth because it's not proven, that different ethnicities have different sized penises. Specifically, you'll hear that African-American gentlemen have the largest penis.
Gentlemen.
But if you actually go and look at where those things originated, much of the research that says that was performed by a horrible
Anthony Cumia.
Racist. Horrible racist who was trying to say that African-American men were like animals and actually used this kind of data to make African American or African men, for that matter, seem unlike everyone else, and to make them more like animals. And so his research is almost the entire basis of this, and he has been shown again and again to have very controversial views on race and intelligence. And
are you referring to Opie and Anthony's Anthony Cumia, who did this research?
Oh, a psychologist. His name was Richard Lynn, and he. He has some amazingly sort of racist things to say. Another researcher is named J. Philip Rushton, who claimed that populations that left Africa developed in a way that required larger brains, more family stability, and a longer life, balanced by lower levels of sex hormones and less sexual activity, and therefore the smaller penises. So he was trying to argue that the Africans who remained in Africa, by definition, would have to have, like, larger penises because they were more like animals. I mean, horrible stuff. So, you know, anyone who wants to perpetuate that kind of, you know, this kind, know where this stuff comes from. There is no good evidence saying that sort of there are huge racial differences in the sizes of penis, and the evidence or the quote-unquote research that does exist is from a questionable source.
In writing and researching this book versus your last two books, did you struggle with finding good research on sex versus on the other two books on just a number of different health and myths about your body and your health? Because you can understand why, when it comes to sex, people might not be honest, or it might be harder to do these studies.
You'd be surprised at how often good research exists, and it's part of, like, what's awesome about it, and also tragic about it. The fact that, you know, so many studies, and often in really good peer-reviewed journals, have been done to show what is true. That's awesome, but what's tragic is that it's almost so much of a waste, because you realize no one knows. You know, people still continue to believe the myths. Someone has dedicated their time, their money, or their life to, like, you know, trying to make this what, you know, try to expand our fund of knowledge and talk more intelligently about sex and how these things are true, and no one knows. And that's part of one of the joys of doing the books, is that, you know, if we get to spread it a little bit, that's awesome. And it's the same thing with the other books as well. You know, if I can, you know, take some of the research. Like, I always go back to the study in the chapter, I think it's on the second book, on artificial sweeteners, where they got, like, you know, they took a bunch of monkeys and they fed them huge amounts of artificial sweeteners, like, every day for, like, 19 years. And, I mean, can you imagine? That's somebody's whole career.
Aspartame.
Yeah, they said, I'm going to do this study. It's going to be my life's work. I'm going to get up every day and go give those monkeys the huge doses of artificial sweeteners that we need to prove this. And they did it for, like, decades. And then they showed that, there was no harm to this. Like, someone dedicated their life to that. We should know, and we should talk about it, and we should end that myth. And instead, you know, it gets buried. No one really knows about it, and everybody continues to sort of believe whatever they read on the internet. And research exists. We should know about it.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, who we talk to almost every week. We talk about health policy, health insurance, the Affordable Care Act, and, of course, health in general. After all, he is an MD, but he's a researcher, and he researches research, and he's got a new book out. It's called Don't Put That in There and 69 Other Sex Myths Debunked. you know, did you talk about, because I don't have the book yet because we're not getting to friends. So did you cover the one about how often men think about sex versus or how often women think about sex? Because there's a, you know, common theme out there that we think about sex every 7 seconds.
Yeah, and that is ridiculous, because if you think about it, every 7 seconds is like as many times a day as when you breathe. That is almost, you know, 57,000 times a day. It's impossible. Anyone who thinks about sex that much would have no time to do anything else in the world ever. And so the idea that you know, first of all, that men could think about sex that much is somewhat ridiculous. But it's also somewhat ridiculous to think that, you know, women don't think about sex, or that, you know, men think about it so many times. So if we go actually again back to the research, there was a pretty darn comprehensive study that's done, you know, almost, I think it was actually like 20 years ago. And more than half of men reported that they think about sex every day or several times a day. Okay, so that's saying, okay, yeah, I think about sex every day or maybe several times a day. That's not every 7 seconds. And almost 20 women did the same. Just over 40% of men reporting about think about sex a few times a month or a few times a week. That's not that much. And 2/3 of women report about thinking about sex that much. So, you know, men and women, men might think about it a little bit more, in the sense that, like, more men will think about it every day. But, you know, if you're saying, if you want to look at it even broader and say, like, well, at least, you know, once a week, then the men and women are almost exactly the same. And so women absolutely do think about sex, and men absolutely don't think about sex nearly as much as we ascribe to them in the popular media.
Am I thinking about sex? Does it qualify if I'm thinking about sex, other people's sex? Like, if I think about, like, say, for example, mm-hmm. people I work with, having sex themselves, like with their partners, is that thinking about sex?
I think about, I would say it's probably about, I'm actually not positive, but I would guess it's about you having sex. And it's also important to remember that, yeah, because I think it was about other people having sex, then it would be almost impossible to turn on the TV these days without being forced to think about it at some point. But so it's probably more thinking about you having sex.
Let's stay on the penis, which is a phrase I've always wanted to say to you.
Do it.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. His new book is Don't Put That in There, and 69 Other Sex Myths Debunked. Can the penis break?
Oh, my God, yes. It's horrible.
Oh,
so this is one where it's like, you know, as a doctor, I've sort of like, I've actually seen this, ironically enough.
Ouch.
I know, I thought about being a urologist for a period of time.
Did you really?
Yeah, there was a period of time when I thought about being a pediatric urologist. I was sort of debating being a pediatric urologist. And so a kid came in, and it was the most awkward thing ever, because he was brought in by his girlfriend and his mom. And it was like, oh, I can't even imagine.
How old was he?
Like 17.
Yikes.
I know. And just like sitting there like going like, this is the, could it truly be any worse? You just broke your penis, and like you're here with your mom and your girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Terrible.
And that's how I met Dr. Carroll.
Anyone. It's not terribly common. You know, there was
what
a study,
is it?
A study
it's
in Canada that looked at like 6 years of data and found like 34 cases. But it happens. It's one in about 175,000 hospitalizations, and it's really serious. You hear like a popping sound. You feel something obviously terrible when it bends and fractures. You get swelling and pain, and it usually is very obviously deformed. You got to have surgery, mostly because they got to get the clots out. They got to make sure that the blood can drain, because if the blood can't drain, that's when everything starts to solidify and you get gangrene. It'd be horrible. It also is even more serious if you manage to sort of break through the urethra, like the.
I'm sorry I asked. Thank
you. Need real surgery. But
moving on.
Once they get the clots out, it's just really a period of rest when you want to avoid erections, and then you wait, and the vast majority of men go on to have very normal lives afterwards. You know, as long as you sort of get it taken care of, it heals. But it's one of those, if you think it happened and it hurts, go to the doctor, go to the emergency room right away.
If you think it happened,
bring your girlfriend and your mom with you.
If you think it happened, I mean, you would know.
But I mean, what I'm trying to say is, like, don't wait it out. Don't, like, be so scared and, like, think I can, you know, man through this. Don't do it. Go get help, even if it's awkward, because you don't want anything super bad to happen that would follow.
Alfred, Chris, how are we doing? You guys good?
No.
You don't seem to.
No, I'm not.
You're very plain-faced as we talk about this album.
It is horrendous. Have you ever heard of this happening before? Yeah. The musician who is in Three Dog Night, I believe, had a famous case of this happening to him. And rough stuff. I do not like it.
No one does.
Chris, ever broke your penis?
I thought everyone peed directly up into their own mouths from it being bent at a 90 degree angle.
No, by choice.
That's different. That's a different issue altogether.
Without breaking your penis.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It's weird. It's basically shaped like an angle iron. It's fine. I'm sure it's fine.
All right, moving on. We're talking about sex myths because Dr. Carroll now has a new book, Don't Put That In There, and 69 Other Sex Myths Debunked. There's a lot of the you should not put blank in blank. Let's get through them. Let's plow through them, sir.
Well, this is when it takes a breath, and I'm like, you really want to go through all?
Can pubic hair turn gray? What do you want from me?
I mean, I could come up with an infinite number of things you could put in an infinite number of areas.
My favorite question to ask ER doctors is, yes, how often do you have a patient come in, man or woman, with something in them that they couldn't get out?
There was an onion in the butt that I remember from residency.
And that's how I met Dr. Carroll.
And that was horrible.
An great onion.
Story. It's such a great story, though, because the punchline is, but that's nothing compared to the time the guy came in with an onion in his butt.
Wow.
Because the story started with something else. Oh, it's it's one of
what? What kind of an onion? A Vidalia?
It was. I would say it was a white onion. I think it was medium sized. It wasn't like one of those huge ones that you see.
Wow. Then you actually witnessed this during your residency.
Oh God, man! You see some bad stuff. At, like,
what's the conversation like with an onion? How come, Alfred? It seems like you're not listening. Onion in the ass.
I don't know. I feel like you want me to do some kind of outrageous facial contortion
during
all of this. I mean, it sucks. I don't like any of this. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing.
This is why it's very hard to do sort of press for this book, and this is why I'm like, you're really going to make me do this, because the entire thing, I'm squirming the entire time. Every interview, I'm like pacing around a room right now as we talk about this. It's like,
As an aside, though, onion bud is kind of a great nickname for someone to get. Although that's a crappy way to get the nickname onion butt.
And ironically enough, it'll make your fart smell better, and onion isn't the greatest.
No, that was the point.
What's this?
The whole point of the original story was somebody came in with the worst smelling thing we'd ever seen, and then the punchline was, but that was nothing like the time the guy came in with an onion. It was horrible, because he'd waited far too long, and oh my God, oh, the odor.
Has anybody ever got something like an air freshener stuck? Because you can understand why someone might want to throw in
a dryer sheet?
A bottle of Lysol.
You're thinking about the object itself. The problem is when it gets embedded in there and you start to get an infection and then an abscess.
Nice.
The smell of a human infection is so horrible. Yeah, so it's like the air freshener would be overwhelmed. Overwhelmed.
So my mom had a patient at her hospital that had a screwdriver up the rear end. They had to completely remove the colon. And
what?
Yeah, they called him Bob the Builder.
Oh, that's just not right at all. Bob the Builder, really? Wow. They had to remove the whole colon?
My publisher actually sent me a book once. It was like somebody put out a whole book of just x-rays of weird stuff in people's bodies, like shockingly weird stuff.
Your publisher sent you that book?
He's like, you would enjoy this based upon like our medical myths.
Guess what your publicist didn't send me?
You're free to take it up with them,
Your book. Do we not want to go any more on the what you can't put in there? Isn't this going to be helpful? As tough as it is to hear.
First of all, it's like the idea is like, well, you can't possibly do that, and of course you can, as this conversation absolutely shows us. You can get lots of things into lots of places, even things that other people would find shocking or impossible. People will say, that can't possibly fit in the vagina, forgetting the fact that a human being comes out of it. What is it I heard in, I think it was a Pat Nuzzle, but it's like, the anus is nightmarishly elastic. Everything is, but sort of that chapter of the book, after getting through what I just said, talks more about the fact that we need to still think about health and safety.
What's,
don't want to move stuff necessarily from one part of the body to the other without cleaning it, because that can, you know, lead to infection.
Yeah.
You want to be very careful not to go beyond people's limits and make sure that lubrication is used so that you don't wind up tearing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that while things can absolutely stretch, things can absolutely go wrong. And so it's important to always be careful and think about it and not, you know, hurt people and not make sure that you do anything. But having said that, it's amazing what people can do.
Well, there's a couple different things here that we're talking about. A woman can put something in one of her two orifices. A man could put something.
Don't imagine if there are so many orifices.
Yeah. A man could put something in his butt. But what's the most common thing that happens? Because in high school, a friend of mine tried to have sex with his vacuum cleaner. A really good friend of mine,
mm-hmm,
named Shmeet Momonik, ironically enough. And
yeah.
Men, I would think men would want to put it in all kinds of things.
Well, again, you always want to just think about safety, and you always want
another friend of mine tried to put it in the bathtub faucet. So, what do you hear the most of? Is it a man trying to put something inside of his butt? A woman trying to put something?
You hear more about. I think, you know. Well, no, I take it back. You hear mostly, I think, about people putting things into the anus. Because that's the one, you know, vagina has an end. Like, you know, it's not, you can lose things in the vagina, but, you know, there's a limited amount of area to search.
Yeah. There's a wall there.
You lose something.
Not that I've ever gotten to it.
And it is in, and you can absolutely lose it and lose control and it will be just in there. And then that's a problem. So I think most of the, you know, cautionary tales and the stories that you hear almost always seem to involve something, either a man or a woman. Ironically enough, I hear stories more often about men losing things up the back door.
A friend of mine puts change in his keister. Is that unhealthy?
That's exactly what you're going to lose, because that's just going to go shoot,
coins.
And then you got to wait for it to come back out. And probably it would, because change is small enough that that you would. In fact, when like people or kids swallow coins, as long as it gets into the stomach, it's almost guaranteed to make it all the way through.
Yikes. All right, we're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, and we're talking about sex myths. His new book is Don't Put That In There. We just covered that one. And 69 other sex myths. When we come back from our break, we'll talk about boobies. We can talk about condoms, pubic hair. This is a fun thing to do. We rarely talk about sex, but it's also important and healthy. And a great book to get for yourself or a friend. Don't Put That In There and 69 Other Sex Myths Debunked. At Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter, by the way. I'm sorry I haven't plugged that. At Aaron E. Carroll. If you're not following him, you should be. We'll be right back with more myths to debunk.
Hey, this is Sean. I voice things here for the show. Actually, we call them rejoins. Anyway, just wanted to say hi, and then I'll talk to you later. Stand Up with Pete Dominic.
All right, we're back, and we've got Dr. Aaron Carroll joining us, at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter, and his new book is about sex, debunking myths about sex. It's called Don't Put That In There. Go buy it right now wherever you get your books from, and let's go right to the phones where Thomas in Boston has his sex myth he'd like debunked. Thomas, you're on with at Aaron E. Carroll. Hi, Thomas.
Hello?
You're on the air, Thomas.
Hey, how you doing, Pete? Dr. Carroll, I'm recently divorced, and I'm 42 years old, and I've been meeting a lot of women in their 40s.
Okay.
And I'm finding that women in their 40s remind me of a lot of my friends when I was 18, and that they have an incredible sex drive. Is that a myth, or is that for real?
Somebody set this guy up? It's like teeing it up. So there is a myth that that women peak sexually much further after men do. The idea that like men somehow peak in their teens and that women peak much later. And that one is so pervasive that I think people even see it. So, you know, part of this myth is you have to define, what does it even mean to peak? Is it when you want the most sex? Is it the age when you have the most sex? Is it when you're masturbating the most? And no one really knows. But let's go through just various metrics that we could pick. If you believe it's the frequency of sex that matters when men or women peak, then men and women are least likely to go without intercourse for a whole year in their late 20s. So in other words, men and women are most likely to not avoid sex same times late 20s. Single men are most likely to have sex four or more times a week in their 30s, and partnered men are most likely to have sex that much in their 40s. For single and partnered women, the most frequent sex is actually in their late 20s. So if you go by, are you going to have a lot of sex? Most men do it later in life. Most women do it earlier in life. So if that's your metric, then men peak later. If you go with masturbation, men and women are most likely to masturbate in their late 20s. If you go with oral sex, men are most likely to get it in their 30s and give it in their 20s. Women are most likely to give and receive it in their 20s. Men are most likely to have anal sex in their 20s. Women are most likely in their later 20s. And so the bottom line is there's no pattern, but there is no evidence that women are peaking later in life. If anything, there's evidence of the opposite, that women are more likely to have more sex and more stuff going on earlier than later. Men, exactly the opposite.
Geez, I can't tell you how accurate those statistics are for me specifically. Wow. All of them. Everything you said.
Well, that's because it's probably that's what happens in the real world instead of what sort of everybody assumes. I think people also forget like all the dry spells of their youth and only remember sort of the intermittent breaks in between versus, you know, the fact that people are more comfortable with their sexuality and probably not as hung up on it later in life, and therefore it's just not as big a deal, and perhaps people more comfortable with it, and it happens more often.
But
no evidence of this at all. None.
Did you have those statistics at your fingertips? Like, or were you reading something there?
I mean, I have a lot of them. You know, you do this stuff enough, and you can sort of rattle them off. But
wow.
Yeah. Which reminds me. So we there's another show that comes out of the Indianapolis, like, YouTube shop is Mental Floss, which is much more popular than Healthcare Triage. And I think today's episode is actually on sex myths and discusses a lot of this stuff, and I did it for them. So, part of why I knew it is because we did this myth for that show, and I remember doing the statistics for that.
What about porn?
Watching porn?
Yeah. Friend of mine watches it.
Everybody does it. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's funny because it's one of those, that's the myth is that, like,
every guy does it.
Well, the myth is, first of all, that it's like that it's every guy, and that it's, you know, that it's guys much more than women. And a lot of this comes from the fact that there has been research done which looks at, you know, whether, you know, how people actually do this and at what age they do it and everything else. But, of course, one of the things they did was they went to college and they asked guys, and they couldn't find a single guy who hadn't watched porn, and therefore they said, everyone watches porn. And it's like, well, okay, if you go and ask, like, college-age boys, are you watching porn, it's very likely that many of them did. And so, you know, you always have to think about what's your population. But if you look at larger studies where they try to get men of all ages, it's not nearly as pervasive as you'd think. So in 2010, they did a large study of more than 14,000 men, and they found that 36% of them reported having watched at least one pornographic film in the last year. In 1973, a similar study found it was 31%, with some minor fluctuations to a low of like 20% in 1980 and a high of 30% in 87.
Yeah, but
the number hasn't changed that much.
Well, who cares about those statistics? All I care about is since the internet. I mean, it was hard. It used to be hard to watch porn.
I just said 2010. It was 36%. I think was the internet not around in your house in 2010, dude?
No, it was, but there was no porn on the internet.
I bet. We're not talking about the dark ages here. You know, they did it. So compared in 2010, it was 36%, which was on the higher side. So yeah, it went up some. But you have to remember that, you know, we always think about the stereotypical, like, 28-year-old male. There are a lot of men in this country who are older and probably just don't do it. And so the numbers are not nearly as high as they think. And, you know, so in 2005, which was, again, a little bit before then, but even looking at what the internet still existed, researchers reported that about 14% of people reported having ever explicitly visualed a sexual website. There was another 2007 survey of 1,500 internet users between the ages of 10 and 17, so even looking at kids, and less than 40% of boys were looking for porn voluntarily. So it's not as high as people think. Now, granted, if you look at sort of the content and the volume of content that seems to be searched for on the internet, it seems like porn is high, but you have to remember that that's because a lot of it is bandwidth, and video takes up a lot of bandwidth. And so that's going to happen. A lot of those statistics are also skewed. A lot of them are also probably a smaller number of users who are, you know, consuming a ton of video content. So the idea that everyone is watching porn is pretty shaky. Men do access it on general more than women, but pretty much everyone is looking at it less than the media would have you believe.
I wonder, you know, when I look up on Google, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but when I look up on search engines, what I like to find out what people are yep. searching for. I feel like they don't chart porn searches or anything sexual in nature.
Well, I imagine you probably can get that data, but you probably have to, like, specifically try to find it.
But, I mean, like, the top 10 Google searches every day.
Is that like, with the safe searches off and everything? I mean, to be honest, I haven't looked it up. But, like,
no, I know, but I just feel like, I don't know, I'd love to know the information. Let me ask you about what is commonly referred to as a wet dream. Friend of mine, who is my age, looks a lot like me, and also lives with us, has them from time to time.
Really?
And I'm fascinated by him that happens, and that because it's interesting that a man could ejaculate without any physical stimulation.
Yep.
That's fascinating. Like, I'd love to be able to just do that on an airplane or a bus or in public. Period.
Well, you have to remember that almost all sexuality in the end comes through the brain. The brain tells you what you feel. The brain tells you what you hear. The brain tells you what you see. It's
really?
All the brain. Yeah, well, think about it. Even when, like, you have your eyes shut and someone touches you, it's just the nerve firing. And then in the end, it's your brain, you know, gets a bunch of neurochemicals together and tells you what you feel and what you think. That's what how the brain works.
Has anybody ever been able to do it, like, I mean, I'm sure there has been people, but consciously?
Then him, but I don't know if I'd buy that. But anyway.
No, but I mean, I've never heard of anybody anecdotally saying, yeah, I can ejaculate without touching myself or being touched.
I don't know, although I would not be surprised if somebody could. But
seriously?
Having said that, remember the brain when you sleep, you're dreaming. And so when you dream, things seem very real, and the brain usually decouples your muscles and everything else, but sometimes it fails. That's when you jerk yourself awake, and that's when you see dogs running in their sleep.
You said jerk yourself awake.
No, you know what you mean. When you wake up and you've just, like, flown an arm or a leg, because it's just like... You
nah,
know,
but tough word to use.
Well, only for you. I'm fine with it. I'm very comfortable with sexuality.
Wow.
So the brain, you know, you're having a dream. The brain's telling you what's going on, and if it's sexual in nature, you know, the brain is convincing you this is actually happening, and it can happen. It can be real enough that it gets you to the point of, you know, being aroused and even to the point of ejaculation. And if we define wet dreams as being asleep, being sexually aroused, having a sexual arousal that brings you to orgasm, and the orgasm wakes you up, women have it too. It's not just
women sexual. Have wet dreams or
well,
orgasms?
Define it the way I said, that they don't ejaculate in the same way that men do. The evidence may not be there, but women have dreams that result in sexual arousal, which ends in an orgasm, which wakes them up. You know, as far back as the 50s, the Kinsey Institute was reporting that almost 40% of women reported having had a wet dream. There was a more comprehensive study in 1986 looking at women in college, and it found that almost about 37% of them, almost 40% again, said they'd experienced a wet dream, and almost a third of them had had it in the last year. We don't talk about this with women as much. Part of that may be just cultural. Part of that may be that there's just not as much evidence again. Like, it's not as if, like, you've soiled your pajamas. And so, you know, boys will worry about what do I do with this, and they have to get up and change it, and women may not have to, and therefore it's just not as big a deal. But absolutely, it does occur that women will have, you know, dreams which result in orgasm, which wakes them up while they are asleep.
What about, since we're on it and since you're so comfortable with this, is that because you're an MD, or are you just that mature?
I think it's partially MD, partially pediatrician. I mean, you get a ton of training to talk. You have to be able to talk to adolescents about sex, and that is not always easy.
So what about the, I don't know how to say this on the radio. I don't know why I can't, but it just seems so weird in this conversation that I host every day. But women can squirt.
Squirt. This is one of those that I cannot figure out. Why we have so little data on.
By the way, Alfred's facial expression didn't change at all when I said that. Nothing.
Why would you it's think not, it would?
This is a typical dinner conversation for me, so it's not a
sorry.
Big deal.
Okay, go ahead, Aaron. Dr. Carroll.
I don't know. This is one of those, like,
what is that?
Say that because I think this is one of those taboo topics.
Yeah, it is.
Sort of freak out about.
Yeah, I'm freaking out right now, so is my entire audience.
Well, you shouldn't. Here's the thing. Almost no studies of this. And the studies that do exist are, like, the worst kinds of studies I can imagine. They basically get a group of like random women together and then try to see if they can squirt when they orgasm. And then when they don't squirt, they go, "Women don't squirt." And we're talking like studies of like 30 women or so. It's like, so first of all, this is not, it appears, terribly common, which we all knew to begin with. But to say it never happens requires you to ignore like all the pornographic evidence that's possible. I mean, it's just like,
what?
It is not hard to find women who have truly pretty good hard evidence that they can squirt. Why yeah. don't they bring those women in and study them? I can't figure this out, but they don't. No one has. Maybe it's just because...
Really?
It's no. It's like, well, the studies that do exist are like of just random women, not of women who are actually, you know, saying that they can squirt.
Well, what is it?
No one knows. That's the thing I'm saying. Like, no one knows.
No one knows? Really?
No. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like...
Somebody just get out a bell jar and then send it in.
Thank you. I don't know. I don't understand. Maybe, like, no one wants to...
I'm going to do this research.
There's the only sort of real scientific study that we could find was an incredibly small one of, like, 38 women who were stimulated to orgasm using vibrators, and they looked at all kinds of stuff, and they were peering at their genitalia very closely, and they didn't see any fluid, and they said, "Women, don't squirt." And I find that that's amazing. There are really no good studies testing what the fluid is that gets released. There was a very small study that tried to examine the question of whether women who ejaculate have bladder problems. In other words, could they be peeing? And they didn't find any reason to think that they were sort of like ejaculating urine. And just, we don't know. But this is one of those. It's like,
that's
this,
gross.
You would think you could do this. You would think we could truly figure it out. I think with just a very small amount of time on the internet, you could gather up a study of a fairly decent number of women and, you know, really figure this one out.
We're going to do maybe one more. More. I'll let you choose.
No, you choose.
It's your book. Okay. Something about boobies.
What would you like about boobies?
I hear women can have orgasms, just some women, by having them manipulated.
Well, you know, women can have orgasms from doing, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I guess we've learned that. So what do I need to know about boobies?
There is a myth that, like, bigger breasts are less sensitive, that somehow that, you know, women with smaller breasts therefore are, you know, benefit from the idea that their breasts are more sensitive and that they therefore have better sex. So, first of all, the first thought behind this was that it was the length of the nerves, that somehow, you know, if the nerves had to be longer to get to the end of the big breast, therefore they couldn't be as sensitive. That is somewhat crazy, because that would mean, of course, that tall women would have less, you know, sensitive breasts than short women, because the nerves get into the brain to be shorter. It would also mean, theoretically, that bigger penises were less sensitive than smaller penises, and ain't no one making that argument. But this actually comes out of a study that really occurred, where they got women to be blindfolded, and then they took out, like, filaments, like hairs of varying sizes, and they slowly would touch them to the breast, and they'd say, "Can you feel that? Can you feel that?"
Wow, that sounds like an
And it turns out
experiment.
That women with smaller breasts were able to, and it's to a statistical significance, to detect a tinier hair filament than the women with the big breasts.
We are...
That's not what corresponds to actual sex. So
the book is Don't Put That In There and 69 Other Sex Myths Debunked. What fun this hour. Dr. Aaron Carroll, thank you so much for your time today, sir.
Buy the book, please.